Come door. Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 5049. We'll start with the agency and Mr. Farber.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. With the indulgence of the committee this morning, we would like to move fairly rapidly through the blue binder that we have provided you this evening. We'll answer a number of the questions that were coming up before in the first 2 days of the presentations you've been hearing. For the record, my name is Woody Farber, Executive Director of the State Scholarship Commission. The first item I would like to call to your attention is Mr. Bender's document that he passed out to you, which identified the various programs as A, B, C, and D down the left-hand side. And if we could just look at that for a second and move down through item A, which is the NEED grant program, and talk about the funding for the NEED.
Excuse me, members. The document that Mr. Farber is referring to is in your white notebook. It should be the first item.
Or I had wrong, had you in the wrong notebook at first.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
If we move down through item A, all of item A is general fund appropriation. And if you could, when you get to the bottom of that, which says total state support for the grant program, just imagine a 5-foot wall across there. And the monies that are appropriated and provided by the legislature for use in the grant program are for grants to students and for administering that grant program. And we can't shift those monies over into the other programs that are on this page. The next item B, is a private award programs. And again, at the bottom, total private award program, all other funds, imagine a 5-foot wall across there. All of those programs are administered under contract with sponsors of those programs, and in those contracts they talk to an amount of money they provide for the awards plus a percentage of that for administering those award programs. And those dollars are constrained within those boundaries, so therefore administering those private award programs. And then we get into the loan program, item C, other funds. That's the Federal Family Education Loan Program, which the Scholarship Commission is a guarantee agency for. And again, those monies are constrained within that program. And any administrative funds we receive from the federal government for operating that program must stay within the operations of that Federal Family Education Loan Program within the Scholarship Commission. So I wanted to go back and give you that visual impression of how our programs are divided and how our operation of those programs are constrained by various rules and contracts that we operate under.
In other words, we can't shift money around to put into the loan program and not fund position.
Senator Trell, that was tried by the legislature in the early 80s. When they attempted to shift $1,062,721 from the loan programs into the grant and scholarship programs, and the federal government came in and pulled an audit and said that you must repay those funds back into the loan program. So we had our hands slapped once before for trying something along those lines.
Representative Ross?
Would you talk again about the $15 million reserve fund that's sitting someplace that we can't get our hands on?
I'd be more than pleased to. I was going to do that at the end, but I'll do it right now, Chairman.
I just don't know if it's under lines that falls under.
In discussing item C, loan guarantee programs,
yes,
that's the reserve fund we're referring to that Representative, in response to a question Representative Winters raised yesterday. We talked about it's called the Federal Student Loan Reserve Fund, which is federal property. There have been several court cases that have tested the ownership of those monies, and I was party to one of those in my previous life and lost at the appeal level in the circuit court in Boston. And they determined that those monies were federal property and belonged to the federal government. Our current balance in that fund is $14,241,240. Of that $14,241,240, only $4,083,251 is unrestricted. All of the rest of those funds are restricted, and by the year 2003, we are going to be required to send those back to Washington, to the federal government.
What does restricted mean?
Restricted means that we cannot spend those monies for any purpose other than sending them back to Washington in the year 2003.
I have a question, Madam Chair. Excuse me. The restricted funds are accumulation, as I understand it, of the 1% of the loan. Is that correct?
Chair, Minister, Representative Winters, the accumulation of that reserve fund is made up of the 1% as well as the recoveries on defaulted loans that we receive from students that are put back into that fund.
So it's a combination of both the default and the 1%.
Chair, Minister, Representative Winters, that is correct.
In your accounting system, do you separate out those two so that you know how much is default and how much is of the earnings from 1%?
Representative Winters, no, we do not. They're all put into the same fund because they are considered property of the federal government and we can't use them for any other purpose.
I guess I'm confused because under normal loan programs with the federal government, you should receive a percentage for managing or administering that particular loan. And you're saying that 1% is not for that purpose?
Chair, Minister, Representative Winters, that's correct. The changes in the Higher Education Act, which we operate that program under, required a segregation of funds between a Federal Reserve Fund and an operating fund. And the operating fund is where we receive federal payments for administration of the program, and monies go into that operating fund, and we can only use that fund for operating the program. The reserve fund, where the 1% guarantee fee goes into when we charge it, which we are not going to do for the next academic year, can only be used to pay default of student loans and cannot be used for any other purpose. So it's a different twist on a program than you would normally expect in a federal loan program, yes.
So along those lines, what percentage do you get for managing the loan?
Chair, Minister, Representative Winters, we receive 0.65% of the new loan amount that we disperse each year for administering the program, and then we receive 0.12% of the loan's balance outstanding, which is currently around $800 million on an annual basis. So that's the monies that we receive from the federal government to administer the program.
You know, it would be helpful if we had that kind of breakout and what's differential between this loan packet because it's very confusing.
Chair, Minister, we would be more than pleased to provide what I just described verbally to Mr. Bender, and he can distribute that to the staff if that's acceptable.
Okay, that'd be fine. Representative
Brown? Would you explain the difference between the restricted and unrestricted funds here and the $14 million?
The Chair, Minister, Representative Ross, the restricted funds in that $14 million are monies which Congress has said the guarantee agencies must send to Washington, D.C. between now and the year 2003 to help defray costs in the Federal Family Education Loan Program. The unrestricted funds, the $4 million plus that I referred to, are monies that we can, that are available to the Scholarship Commission to pay defaulted loans to lenders in the program.
So we have $4 million that we would pay back defaulted loans in the state of Oregon from our own students, and we have $10 million that has to be paid back to the federal government to cover their costs.
Chair, Minister, Representative Ross, that is accurate.
Thank you.
So the student takes down a loan, 1% of that loan, or federal loan, 1% is taken out, and then return to the federal government basically for administrative costs. Is that how?
Sure, Minutes. The 1% that is taken out is put into the Federal Reserve Fund and is used to defray defaulted loan costs in the future.
Okay. But
so it's a reserve for the potential of that loan defaulting.
Okay. Then what's the $10 million that needs to be returned?
Congress, Chairman, Congress felt that there were excess money sitting in those reserve funds around the 36 guarantee agencies across the country, and they decided $1 billion of that should be returned in the Balanced Budget Act in 1997. And then an additional amount was picked up in 1998 with legislative passage, which is one of the reasons why the commissioners in examining the 1% charge to new borrowers decided that it was in the best interest of the residents of Oregon to reduce their cost by not charging that 1% fee for the next academic year, because we didn't need to grow that reserve fund any larger. It's large enough to cover the potential down the road. We've run some financial analyses over the next 5 years, and it's large enough now to cover those potentials, so the commission felt why charge students the money to build a reserve fund, which we don't need to build. Keep it at the level we have it at currently, and that will be sufficient going down the road. So that was.
You think the $4 million is enough to meet the obligation from a default?
Sure, Minutes, yes, we do. We've done a 5-year analysis, and we feel quite comfortable that that is enough. That amount grows up and goes up and down depending on the fluctuation of default payments and recoveries. And based on our best estimates at this point in time, we feel that it is adequate to meet those needs. If I may, now I'll go to the blue book, and I'll walk through blue book subject to your committee's needs fairly quickly, because a lot of the information is already covered in discussions and questions as we have moved through it. But as we're talking about the various programs, the first question comes up is what's the commission's plan as to how we're going to administer these programs. And one of the major items we've been working on is a 5-year strategic plan for the scholarship commission. Where do we want to be in 5 years? How can we best meet the needs of the students, the schools, and the lenders in the state of Oregon as we move through the next 5-year period? And how do we measure success in doing that? Providing information is a key element of that strategic plan, so that students and their parents know what's available to them for financing post-secondary education, and thereby feel that there is a possibility of obtaining a post-secondary education as they move through the process. And the very first strategic goal we have in there is expand the grant and scholarship aid for Oregon post-secondary students. And you've heard testimony to that previously. You've heard a great deal of statistics. I won't bore you with those all over again. But the goal, as Commissioner Mesereau stated earlier, the two main goals the commissions have focused on is year-round funding and meeting 25% of cost. Second item there is individual new grants trying to push that up to 25%. We're now down to meeting 11% of cost, whereas previously we were in 70-71, we were meeting 20% of the students' cost. Historical data at the bottom of page one shows the number of recipients being 28,102 in 1993-95, and the unfunded eligible students is 23,385. And the reason I want to point that number out is at the top of page two, the unfunded students drop down to 9,743. The reason for that drop was the commissioners made a policy decision to decrease the individual grants made to eligible applicants so that they could fund more eligible applicants. So that's why the unfunded number dropped so dramatically, because the number of funded applicants went up almost 4,000 in that time period from one year to the next. But in the The biennium we're in, we're projecting almost 9,000 unfunded eligible students. And as you heard from President Berger yesterday, the majority of those unfunded students are ones that go to community colleges because of their cycle of application. We have introduced a bill, H-Bill 2250, to help fund more students through a private scholarship program by providing tax credits to corporations that set up scholarship programs for students. The second strategic goal is to strengthen family financial preparation for post-secondary education. And two of our packages are aimed at supporting that goal. Package 101, the public information coordinator, and package 205, the volunteer coordinator position. And the goal is to try to reach families earlier in the planning process so they don't opt themselves out of post-secondary education before they know what's available to help pay for that post-secondary education. And also, House Bill 2249, when people see the name Scholarship Commission, they have a narrow view of what the responsibilities and capabilities of that organization are. So the commissioners have asked that the name be changed to Oregon Student Assistance Commission to reflect the broader impact of the various programs the commission has available to it to support post-secondary education. The third strategic goal is provide access to loans for Oregon students and parents through the Oregon Federal Family Education Loan Program, which we have just spent a great deal of time discussing here before. And again, option package 102, packages 102 and 301 are in here to help us provide better access to post-secondary education. Our goal is to be the guarantor of choice in Oregon for the loan program so that we can better coordinate the students' grants, scholarships, and loans, thereby helping students borrow responsibly as they move through post-secondary education. You'll see later on some information which shows borrowing levels in Oregon which are troublesome at a minimum. And then I would also say here that all of these option packages that we're talking about are funded from monies from other sources. They're not funded from general fund sources. It's either the private awards programs that provide the funding for the scholarship programs or the Federal Family Education Loan Program that provides the funding for all the other option packages. And then the last strategic goal is creating a center for Oregon high school students to achieve certificate of initial mastery, and that's HB 2251.
I had a question about using those funds for the staffing. You think there will be no problem using other funds for that, and the source of the other funds is federal dollars?
Representative Chairman, Senator Crowe, yes, the source funding is the Federal Family Education Loan Program, so that's where the funding source is drawn from.
Okay, and we have a problem using money for staff. What does the money normally go for?
The money is meant for operational costs, which would include staffing and the costs associated with that staffing, public information campaigns, things of that nature.
Okay, so it really does fit into what the money is intended for.
Yes, it does, Senator Crowe.
Is there a match required for those other funds?
Chair, Minister, Representative Winters, no, there is not a match requirement. It's all within that 100% other funds, yes. If I could move on to the next strategic goal, advocate for students, we see that as one of our primary responsibilities. We must be out there obtaining as much possible information and aid monies for students as we possibly can. It starts with the Office of Degree Authorization to ensure the quality of programs is as high as we possibly can and remains high within the state of Oregon, the grant division, and down through the loan division, and that's what those option packages are there to support. Before I move on to the next section, are there any questions I respond to in that section?
Representative Ross?
Now, I understood from your earlier explanation of these option packages that that some of these funds are coming directly from the federal government for this specific purpose. And could you again review where the money is coming from for 101, 205, and 301?
Yep.
So that we understand whether they are taking money away from activities that we would prefer over those.
The items 101 is being funded from the operating expenses for the Federal Family Education Loan Program.
And so that is one where you have a choice about whether to do it or not.
That's correct.
And if you don't do that, that money could go back into the to be available for more loans. Isn't that right?
Not. Representative Ross, no, that does not affect the amount of money available for loans. That just affects how we use the money to administer the program.
Okay. So it's operating expenses that you have to use for operation.
Representative Ross, that is correct.
Okay. Okay. 205?
Representative Ross, 205 is a volunteer coordinator position that is being funded in cooperation with the Community Foundation is the right name for it. So that's being provided by a private source here, the Community Foundation in Oregon, to support that volunteer position.
Okay, so that other fund is private money donated specifically for that purpose.
Representative Ross, that is correct.
Okay. And the 301 is, as I understood yesterday, is federal money that is specifically focused on educating students about default risk. Right.
Representative Ross, that is correct. 301 is interest earnings that is we must use for educating students on default risk and default reduction initiatives. And if we do not use the money for those purposes, then we do not have the use of them.
And that's interest on what?
The interest off the restricted account, the restricted monies I was talking about earlier, that we're going to be sending back to Washington by the year 2003.
Okay, and so the interest on the restricted funds cannot in any other, this is the way we can use them to benefit our students, is by using those for educational purposes.
Representative Ross, that is correct.
Thank you, that's helpful.
Okay. I guess I'm totally confused. Because yesterday I understood that it was the interest loss of $2.1 million that was set aside for interest earnings. Did I do that incorrect?
Chair Ross, Representative Williams, I'm sorry if I confused you with the answer yesterday, but that restricted amount is moved into a separate fund over a time period,
mm-hmm.
and that the current balance is 2 point something, but in the end it will be over $10 million. So it shifted between funds within our accounting system, but it's still restricted money.
Other questions? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Ross. The second area I want to talk to, the next area, is to talk about the how we staff our organization, the Scholarship Commission, and talk to the ratio of administrative staff to program staff, beginning on page 5. If we look back over the last three biennia, we see a ratio that goes from 1.1 to 5.68 to 1.5.2. Some of the change in that in the 1997-99 biennium was the addition with the support of the legislature of information services personnel to bring the commission more up to speed technologically. Commissioner Bell talked about the number of hits we've seen in the last 12 months to our web page. That has become a very popular source of information for students, financial aid officers, and families of students across the state as they try to gather as much information as possible on aid available. So that's why that ratio has fluctuated up and down over the last few bienniums. and we're bringing it back down some more this biennium because the staff we're talking about in the option package is our program staff more than anything else. On page 6, when we look at the cost of administration versus program costs, those numbers fluctuate quite widely. And the reason those numbers are fluctuating quite widely from biennia to biennia really has to do with non-administrative dollars, monies that are in the Federal Family Education Loan Program where we by default. So if we're successful in loan volume going up because we are the guarantor of choice, which we're trying to be in the state of Oregon, then somewhere down the road from that, the default purchase amounts are going to go up. So that will drive the ratio down some more because the program costs will go up. And as you move forward with additional costs in that area, and say default recoveries, for instance, that will again, as the default recoveries go up, that will drive the ratio down also. So that ratio can fluctuate fairly widely when you have changing volumes both in new loans that you are making and in defaults which you are purchasing recoveries off those defaults. So that's why you see a large jump in 97-99 from 1.68 to 2.58%, and now it's headed back down again. It's down to 2.18% now.
I'm sure. Question. Each of the institutions that provide the educational programs have financial aid staffs, and they're concerned about one, granting the loans, and two, seeing that eventually those loans are repaid, plus they have grants as well as loans in the sort of package. How do you coordinate what you do with what they do? Who does what?
Chairman, Senator Crow, that is one of the items that we are working on, but we need to do more work on, and that is to enhance our services in the area and coordination of information and coordination of loan programs, grant programs, and scholarship programs with the financial aid offices and with the lending institutions so that the messages are consistent across the state of Oregon, and students have a clear picture of what responsibilities they are getting into. Part of the information package we were talking about yesterday in response to Representative Winner's question is to provide videos for entrance and exit counseling, so that students can clearly understand the responsibilities they're getting into when they borrow these monies, to provide entrance counseling on a web site and exit counseling down the road. So that's how we try to coordinate with those financial aid officers.
Well, it sounds like it's an ongoing problem, and you all both have been in the business a long time together doing this, so there still are needs for better communication.
Chairman, Senator, I would agree with that assessment. It's an ongoing issue. It's one that we need to be diligent about paying attention to as we move forward, especially as we see the change going. If we look at the chart on the easel over here to my left, your right, we see that loans have grown tremendously from the early 70s as a percentage of the aid available to the point we're at today. I think now we're somewhere at 58%. Loans make up 58% of the aid available, whereas in 1970-71, we were back down around 29%. Loans were 29% of the aid available. So we've seen a tremendous growth in the percentage of aid. Yeah.
Is your agency responsible for making sure those loans are repaid, or is each of the individual institutions responsible?
Chairman, Senator Trill, there are the programs that we administer, the Federal Family Education Loan Program we're talking about here today. We are ultimately responsible for ensuring the repayment of those loans. If the students or student borrowers and parent borrowers do not pay back the lending institution, and with our help, we can't convince these students and parents to repay, which I have to say, as Jeff referred to yesterday, we've been quite successful in doing preventing those defaults. 91% of the requests sent to us were able to cure before they reached that default category. but some we are not able to cure. And we are responsible for buying that loan and then attempting collection from the defaulted student or parent borrower. We have been blessed, I have to say, by the legislature with a number of collection tools over the past few years. For instance, the agreements with licensing agencies that we can put pressure on defaulted students that if they don't agree to a repayment schedule, then they can lose their license to practice in the state. The sharing of information from the employment department and their records. We send them a magnetic file, and they respond back to us on the matches, and we get current addresses and employment information, so we can then begin wage garnishment on those defaulted borrowers. So there are a number of tools that we have been given that also have improved our collection capabilities, which our recovery rate on defaulted loans is now over 50%.
Thank you.
Senator Hyson?
Woody, I know that you recognize the questions that have been asked by the committee the last couple of days is how can we get all money possible into the scholarship funds to loan out? And it appears to me you've done a good job in operating as an efficient operation. But I am really concerned about adding FTEs, even though it's federal money, that's our money. Maybe we need to get after, to the federal government to send us money, and we have the option of putting it into scholarships. So we have the operation of building, the infrastructure, so to speak. But I'm really uncomfortable with adding FTEs. For instance, in the public information side, you're doing a good job of that already. We witnessed the pent-up demand. We could use an extra $10, $20 million. You don't need to sell people, I don't think, on, please come and make a loan. And with the new technology, and I know you're doing it, that there ought to be a way to keep track of the individuals that apply and how they're doing and whatnot. But I will just have to say I am really concerned about the addition of FTEs. I don't want this commission to be just like so many government agencies that grow with bodies, even though you can justify it because of your increase in business. But anyway, that's my real concern.
Ms. Sanders?
Mr. Barber, I had a question about page 6. Are those numbers that you're identifying there just the amounts in your administrative and information service division program areas?
Chairman, Mr. Binger, that is correct.
Okay. I do think that the subcommittee should note that there are some additional costs that may be considered administrative versus program, in the sense that some of the state funds that are used to support the NEED grant support personnel and services and supply expenses that don't fall within the organization of those two program areas. And if you included those, that would increase the administrative cost by about $1.1 million over the $3.09 that is there. But I think that was just, that's just another way of looking at it, because there are additional personnel and service and supply costs in the grant program and in the loan program.
Madam Chair, could I ask back a question?
Certainly.
Following up on Senator Hartung's concern about FTE, at the staff level, has there been any discussion of rather than increasing their FTE of contracting with individual institutions to do this educational work?
No, we have not.
Thank you.
I wonder at some point if you couldn't prepare us a little document explaining why the positions you want are cost effective, and so that we can all see that. That would be good.
Chairman, mm-hmm. Any other questions? Chairman, in partial response to Senator Hartung's comment about staffing, additional staffing, one of the processes we're going through right now is to look at a reorganization of the scholarship commission to more effectively use staff. It doesn't show in any of the documents because we have not finished that process looking through all of the functions we have to perform and how we have to perform them. But that is one of the items we're moving through right now as part of my looking at what the organization is doing and the commissioner's interest in seeing that done.
So are you looking to streamline the roles that your employees, people that are on the commission or on the that administrate the program, and consolidate some of the FTE? Is that what you're saying? Or?
Sure, Ms., that is correct. We're with the changing in the funding availability and funding model for the loan program, the MSX loan program, we are going to be required to do more with less. So we are looking at how do we bring that about in as cost-effective a way as possible. So we will be streamlining the roles. We will be structuring the organization so we can be more responsive to the needs of students and schools and lenders throughout the state. We can move forward to page 7, and as far as talking to the budget notes that were in the last biennial budget, specifically budget note that FC 5530 that talked to out of the total monies available for need grants, $1 million to be allocated exclusively to students attending a state public institution of higher education. We fully expect that by the end of June, the full $1 million will have been dispensed appropriately, and we will have funded 1,290 students with that $1 million in that budget note. And the second major budget note as far as grant monies, the budget continues with supplemental grants to students attending private nonprofit colleges in Oregon, which is Mr. Bender referred to previously as the SUNSA Award, is the terminology that's used for it. And we fully expect that we will have dispensed the $3 million over the last biennium to 2,836 students by the end of June. So we have met both of those. We'll have met both of those budget notes in their entirety. The other budget, the second budget note in the B, is Educational Endowment Funds Earning Distribution, HB 3695. And that one was more of a restriction in the amount of Education Endowment Funds received.
Mm-hmm.
I need to just go back and get a little more clarification about the budget note. I understand what the budget note, the allocation, if I'm understanding it correctly, that during this biennium, you will have allocated $1 million to students at public institutions, including community colleges, and then $3 million to students in independent nonprofit institutions. What I wanted to ask was, was your projection of this split the same for the coming biennium?
Sure, Minister of Senator Boss, yes, it was.
And so out of every $4 that's allocated, one goes to a student in a public institution and three goes to a student attending a private institution. That's correct?
I'm sorry, excuse me.
No, that's not correct.
Okay.
Thank you. This refers to special allocations in the total amount of the need grant that were specifically reserved for either students in the private or students in the public sector. If you look back on pages 2 of the blue book, this shows the distribution in its entirety. Most of the funds are not specifically restricted to either sector. And when the funds were distributed in 97-99, you can see that approximately almost half of them, 15.6 out of 31.5, went to the public employee.
Right. Okay, thank you. I was having problems understanding. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Chairman. B is the Educational Endowment Fund earnings. For the 1997-99 biennium, all earnings in excess of $3.5 million will be transferred into the appropriate of the State Scholarship Commission. And We began receiving, actually in April, received the first of those transfers of $302,926. And then, based on current legislative wording, beginning the 1st of July for the next biennium, there will go back up to the 25% of earnings on the endowment fund will go into the scholarship program. And that has already been built into the numbers that staff have provided you, the $4.26 million from the lottery fund. And so that's where that estimated amount came from. The next section in the binder, programs and services, we've talked at length about the Federal Family Education Loan Program. There's both staffed loans for students and PLUS loans for parents. And we deliver those to all undergraduate and graduate students and their parents that apply to us and are eligible for loans. This, as has been stated earlier, this is strictly a need, unmet need that's used to determine whether or not the students are eligible for the Stafford loans and for the interest payment while they're in school. If they're not eligible under that need, then they can borrow what's called an unsubsidized loan, and then they're responsible for the interest from day one. The parents are responsible for interest from day one. So the parents are fully responsible for interest. The parents under the parent loan program can borrow up to the difference between the cost of education and other sources of aid for that student to attend post-secondary, that post-secondary institution. So it's a fairly unlimited amount in the parent loan program. That formerly was restricted a few years back to $10,000 maximum. And when those limits came off, we saw the parent borrowing jump fairly tremendously. In actual loan sizes, and that's another troublesome area. Page 10, we have the need grant and the SUGSA program. We've talked about that at length. The grants range from $936 to $1,638 per year, depending upon the type of institution the students, the cost of the institution the students attending, and then the supplemental grant ranges between $756 and $1,624 per year. The private award programs are those programs that we administer under contract with the donors, and those types of scholarships and grants are typically both merit and need-based, and it can be either. It really depends upon what the sponsor of the scholarship or grant would like to see that program look like. The large one, obviously, is the Ford program.
Senator
Trump? Can you tell me a little bit about the supplemental award, grant award? What monies provide that?
The supplemental grant award, if we were to look at the document that was prepared by staff under the NEED grant program, talks about the supplemental grants for private colleges. The $3.08 million in the next biennial budget, and that's the amount that supports that supplemental award.
Okay, and that is that lottery dollars from the endowment fund?
Chairman, Senator Trump, that's general fund appropriation dollars.
The general fund appropriation dollars, okay. So we make a general fund appropriation for the NEED grant. We also make a general fund appropriation for the supplemental award.
Chair, Minister, and Phil, that is correct.
How long have we been doing that? Just for the latter.
Chair, Minister, and Phil, this will be the second biennium.
The one to win is the second biennium. The second biennium. So it started in 1995.
That's correct, Senator Phil.
I've never been on Ways and Means since 1995.
Madam Chair.
Let's
go back up on page 10, when you talk about the NEED grant and state NEED supplemental award, can you describe, I know we had testimony in this committee, but what is the criteria of NEED, again? I'm sure you've covered that before, but is that sort of in isolation from for example, when we talk about the Stafford loan, I mean, what's the niche you're trying to fill there? I guess that's the question.
Sure, Mass Representative Edwards, the need definition is the neediest of the needy.
What's that mean?
That means that dependent students must be less than 75% of the median family income. Independent must be less than 50%. For instance, a dependent student from a family of four to be considered eligible for the program would have to have a family income $34,680 or less. An independent student from a family of two would have household size of two would have to have a income of $15,720 or less to be eligible for the NEED grant program.
Well, no, that's income level. I'm sorry.
Income level $15,720. Okay. So the definition of need for the NEED grant program is much more restrictive than the definition of need for the loan program.
Just to mention to the committee that these income limitations are on page 110 of the White Party book.
And just one last question on it. Is that policy that you established, or is that statutory as far as who are the needed?
Chairman, Representative, that's policy established by the Scholarship Commission commissioners.
And do you readdress that periodically? I mean, if you Matt, my assumption is you would.
Sure, Ms. Representative Edwards, the commissioners do readdress that on a continual basis, basically.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The next item, the next program on page 10 is the rural health. We have three programs down through there, which are very small programs, and Rural Health Loan Repayment Program, the Oregon Nursing Loan Program, the Individual Education Account. And those are all fairly small programs and have small amounts associated with them. Same with the Community Service Vouchers Program, which is a tuition vouchers for use at Western Oregon University. They're vouchers of $875. The Federal Robert Byrd Scholarship Program is, again, a federal program, federal scholarship program. Is a very extensive application process that the high school seniors go through, and a review process by volunteers who come into our offices and read those applications every year to determine who the recipients of those $1,500 scholarships will be. And then the last one is an informational type of activity, workshops, toll-free numbers, EdNet, video cassettes, etc. And on page 12, we talked to the Office of Degree Authorization.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'd just like to go back to page 10 for a moment and just an explanation on the education vouchers for job placement. How many of those vouchers do you issue, and how do the individuals learn and know about those vouchers?
Chairman, if I could turn the staff on that.
State your name for the record.
For the record, Jim Beyer, Scholarship Commission. Chairman, as Representative Winner. The individual education accounts are established for Jobs Plus participants after they have participated successfully for 30 days in a subsidized job. The employer begins paying into an education account. Eventually, that money, when they have ceased participation in the subsidized employment opportunity, that money flows to us to hold for the student. So they're notified of the availability of those funds from the Jobs Plus program. Then we, in turn, begin communicating with the Jobs Plus participant to notify them that they have this fund available to them for they or their family to use. And this program is growing. We have, I believe, we have over 1,200 individual education accounts that exceed $800,000. and they can use that for any type of training and education that they would like. It's not necessarily formal education. It can be to take a computer class, insurance training, anything that they feel and we concur is a good opportunity.
How much has been used?
Spent? About $100,000 of that has actually been spent by students. Most of the growth in Jobs Plus has occurred in the last 2 years. Started very slowly. It began on a 6-county pilot basis, and it went statewide, I think, 2 years ago. So the growth in the numbers of individual education accounts coming to us has really taken off in the last 2 years. So we expect the continued growth in the use of those funds.
Do you know how many individuals have are part of the 100,000? You know, we're talking about 100, 200, 300?
327 students. We participate.
Any questions?
Last program that we are responsible for is the Office of Community Authorization.
On the next page, the community service vouchers at Western, how do those work?
For the record, again, Jim Byers, Scholarship Commission, Chairman of Senator Crow. This is a program uniquely, at this point, funded for Western Oregon University. Through their career service program, they ask students on campus that are interested in funded internships to spend up to 10 hours a week for an entire term in some level of direct community service. So they get credit. They also end up with, it approaches 200 hours in that term.
Sounds like a good idea. How's that funded? Is that general fund?
It has, yes, right now it's general fund. Began as lottery fund, and in this current biennium it's general funded.
Thanks, Chair Mass. Thank you, Jim. The Office of Degree Authorization is responsible for really three functions: authorizing all new degrees offered at private independent institutions, doing program reviews when new programs are proposed at public institutions and there is a potential significant adverse impact with another institution in the area of that new program, and then degree validation where someone asks for validation of a degree that someone else is using in the state of Oregon and has claimed. The next page, page 13, talks to the per unit cost of these programs and services provided in the grant scholarship programs, state funded awards for every $100, it costs us $1.21. And for the private funded awards for every $100, it's $7.12. And that goes back to the criteria that the individual donors put on those need and merit scholarships and grants and what it takes to review those applications and make sure that the merit is there that they're asking us to ensure. And those are the costs that are covered under the contracts with the sponsors of those programs. The Federal Family Education Loan Program, we go through the various costs there, and the one that jumps out at you is the cost of collection recoveries, $12.61 for every $100 collected, and that is because collections is a one-on-one proposition. Our staff need to convince the defaulted borrower that they need to repay that money back into the scholarship commission. So that's where those costs come from on that aspect of it.
What would your feeling be to contract that part of debt collection out to collection agencies doing that yourself?
Excuse me, Chair Menace, we do contract out some portion of that to other collection agencies when we have reached a point where we feel we can't get any more money out of the defaulted borrowers. The reason we don't contract more out is because of all of the items we have available to us for collection purposes that wouldn't be available to those private collection agencies, that being the employment records, the license, the ability to work with the licensing agencies, et cetera. So we have more tools available to us that they wouldn't have as a non-state agency.
Okay. Everybody good?
Thank you. What percentage of your of the debt is getting off?
Chairman Mintz, Representative Winters, we are not allowed to write off any percentage of the debt.
We have no write-off.
So we have no write-off. We do, while we have no write-off, we do settle accounts at times if we feel that the possibility of collecting monies is going to be less than what the cost incurred in doing that. So we will settle it for less amount. And I don't know what, it's a small sum percentage, I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but we can get that for you.
So instead of writing it off, you just renegotiate the debt at a lesser level, right?
Sure, Ms. Representative Winters, that's correct.
And I would like to add information.
Page 14, we talk about relationships to programs outside the agencies. And as we've talked in detail, we have a quite a bit of interaction with the U.S. Department of Education in Washington, since they are the overseers of the Federal Family Education Loan Program. And we are projecting that 86% of the agency revenue will come from that program in the next biennium. And we will disperse $175+ million in loans over the next biennium. The State Student Incentive Grant Program is also a federal program, which is overseen by the U.S. Department of Education. And next biennium, we will receive $983,200, a projected amount, which will go into the NEED Grant Program and be used to fund NEED grants. The Robert Byrd Honors Program, scholarship program, which we talked about previously, that's 300 renewable scholarships for $1,500 per year for outstanding achieving students in the state of Oregon. And then there's other student financial aid programs which are directly to the institutions in the state. In dealing with post-secondary institutions, as we talked about before, we are in constant interaction with institutions, especially the financial aid offices at those institutions, helping them with their information campaigns, helping them with their students, et cetera. And that also includes the activities associated with the NEED grant program and interacting with them in the NEED grant program. And the office reauthorization, as I stated earlier, does interact very heavily with the, especially the private institutions in the state that are trying to set up new programs to a large region. Secondary schools, we work with them through the workshops that we've talked about before, publications and videos to try to get as much information out to the students and their parents as early as possible as to how they can finance post-secondary education. We work with various foundations, trust officers, and the private award programs, because that's how we manage those programs, and that's where the donors put their money to support these programs. And then private award donors, obviously, trying to convince more and more of those persons who have an interest along those lines to set up scholarship programs for students in Oregon. There are some factors out there which are going to affect our programs in the next biennium. The growing need for post-secondary education. We talked earlier about the benchmark. Commissioner Bell talked about the goal of 45% of Oregonians having a bachelor's degree in 2010. That's going to place additional strains on educational institutions to provide space to educate those students and financial aid programs on providing the aid for those students as they begin moving through that process. The growth in the graduation rate in Oregon over the next few years. The numbers we have seen show a continuing growth in the senior class size through the year 2010. And that's going to be putting more students at the level of being moving from high school into post-secondary education. So that's going to be, put more stress on it. College costs are growing at a faster rate than inflation. If we look at changing college costs and weighted averages from 1989-90, there was $7,115 per year. 97-98, there were $10,728 a year, a 51% increase over that period of time, 9-year period of time. While Oregon income hasn't grown nearly as fast, family of four in 1989 was $31,741. In 1998, that same figure was $46,229, or a 47% increase. And then inflation pretty much ate up a lot of that increase. If we look at inflation in 89, CPI for Portland was 120.4. Then in 98, it was 167.1, or a 39% increase. So those are the pressures that are going to be constantly squeezing families as they try to fund the money needed for post-secondary education. We're also concerned, as you saw on the seesaw chart that was put up there, we also saw a increased reliance on loans. Last year for which we have data, we see $300 million in loans to students in the state of Oregon, and $21 million in scholarships and grants that we administer. That's a tremendous imbalance that concerns us. And that's why we want to try to educate students and their families as much as possible about borrowing responsibly. The next page, page 17.
Just a comment on that. You think that there's some irresponsible borrowing. What does that mean exactly? People are borrowing when they might get grants? Is that what that means, or what?
Chairman Senator Trow, I would say two situations. And maybe I wouldn't use the term irresponsible, but uninformed maybe is a term I would use.
Okay.
One, the fact that students, when they look at a financial aid package, they don't understand everything that's in that package. All they're concerned about is how do I pay this semester's cost. And so they're going to do whatever they have to pay those costs. And they don't necessarily look at it and say, is it possible to reduce my living expenses by $500, therefore borrow $500 less. That's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is not knowing all of the scholarships and grants that might be available to them up front, which is our informational campaign, which is why we want to try to reach them earlier in the process so that they are better informed and the families have a better feel as to what might be available to them to finance their post-secondary education.
Sure. So out of not knowing these other opportunities, they just borrow more when maybe they could borrow somewhat less and do it other ways.
Chairman, Senator, that is our feeling, yes.
Representative Baxter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Woody, could you discuss in some detail the relationship between financial aid offices at each university or college campus in relation to the state scholarship commission?
Chairman, Representative Backman, we work constantly with the financial aid offices of each educational institution around the state, working, feeding them information and them feeding us detailed information on students as far as what their aid package looks like, what their costs are, and how they're going to meet those costs. And so we are constantly working with them to identify the sources of funding that would be available to them for their students.
They might ask you about sources as they talk to or work with students on the individual campus, and they would, and the financial aid office would communicate with you a whole host of things.
Chairman, Representative Backman, that is correct. They communicate with us. They ask us questions on the administration of the program, at programs that we have. They ask us eligibility questions on students who might be eligible. For instance, for a subsidized loan versus non-subsidized loan, which lowers the cost to the student, and how they can make some judgments on their part to make that happen.
We've got about another 10 minutes. So you might want to cover the high points, and you might want to give those for hearing since public testimony.
Page 17 just gives you the result visibly of the lack of grant funds for students and families in the state. And two in particular jump out, the community college borrowing, which shows that students borrowing through our education loan program borrow almost twice as much, about 82% more than students in a national survey. And students in graduate and professional programs borrow almost twice as much when they owe almost twice as much when they leave school as they did in a national study conducted. So that those borrowing levels concern us, and that's something that we are going to be trying to address as we move forward.
Wait, is this $21,000, is that an average for the graduate?
That's average, yes.
These are all average.
These are all average term, yes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a quick question, and I look for it. This tax, you know, we've seen a lot of graphics and information, but there's no demographics that talk about the grouping that City College what students are accessing these loans. You know, how many of the minority students are really involved in the scholarship program, that kind of information. It would be helpful to know what students we are attracting into the scholarship program.
Chair, Minister, Representative Winters, I would agree that would be helpful to know, but since those conditions aren't a requirement for receipt of either the grant and scholarship or the loan, we're not able to ask those questions legally. So
we have no
information. So we have no idea.
Do you have any idea of demographics of where students are coming from?
Chair, Minister, Representative Williams, we would be able to obtain that. As a matter of fact, we are working on a chart now that shows around the state where the grants are going based on address.
And how many are coming from Salem, and how many from rural areas, and how many from metropolitan Fort Myers?
Representative Williams, that is correct. That's what we're working on now.
Okay.
Page 18 just talks about, in written form, what I just stated as far as where the pressures are coming from, where the borrowing is going. And then the competition in at the bottom of the page in the federal student loan arena talks to the guarantors from other states, guarantee agencies such as the Scholarship Commission, which would like to do business in Oregon because we have a good reputation of students repaying their loans and parents repaying their loans in Oregon. So that's why they would like to do business here. But we feel that hurts us because then we are not able to coordinate that borrowing, which has allowed us to keep that defaulted level at the level we've kept them at. We talked about the federally mandated structures and the fiscal operation of the guarantee agencies earlier, and also about reauthorization. We've covered all of that. How do we make our success? Basically, there are three benchmarks, 26, 28, and 29. That we fall under, and it's felt that the SIM Achievement Loan Program and HB 2251 would have allowed us to better address benchmark number 27 also. The evaluation of the programs in the Office of Degree Authorization, we did not meet our internal timeline of completing degree authorization applications within 6 months due to a change in administrator in December in that office. So we have brought in contract personnel to help us eliminate that backlog and bring things up to date in that office. And we are now currently up to date in that office. And we'll keep it up to date until we bring a new administrator on board, which should happen next month sometime.
I'm sure.
Sure.
Is that office funded by a general fund, or is it funded by fees, or a combination?
Chairman, Senator Curley, is funded by a combination of general fund appropriation and fees.
Is it possible to make that funded entirely by fees?
Chairman, Senator Curley, in my opinion, I would have to say no, because there's only one function, which is about 50% of the time that they perform that's directly related to something that we could charge a fee for, and that's a degree authorization application. the remainder of the work they do is to mediate disputes between public institutions and private institutions in the state as far as programs offered and validate degrees that people are claiming in the state of Oregon. And I would think that it would be very difficult to turn that into a fee-supported function.
What sort of relationship does this office have to the TSPC, which approves at least teacher training courses?
Chairman Senator Trill, TSPC will not approve a teacher training course unless the office gives the authorization to authorize that course.
So it authorizes this. And then it's
that's correct. Page 21 talks about other effectiveness measures. The important one I feel there being in the FFELP loan program, we're 15th lowest in the nation on cohort default rate. At the latest one was 8.10%. Dollars collected on defaulted dollars for all loans which are under repayment is 5.09%, so that's a different comparison of defaults, if you will. And then recovery rate from those students who have defaulted previously, we're at 57.95%, 8th best in the country on recovery rate. So if you look at all those numbers, they're very positive. And then response to stakeholders has been much positive in the private award programs and other activities that we have performed. In the cost control section of the binder on page 22, We talked to the growth of the private award program, looking for monies, encouraging sponsors to support grant scholarship programs so that we don't have to use general funds for those. The Aspire program, which we talked about earlier, which is a volunteer program, which is totally supported from private donations, and the addition of the other, the Rural Health Services program, nursing home program, et cetera, without additional staffing being put on to operate those programs when they were assigned to us. In the loan division, we grew slightly over 25% in loan volume last year without increasing the staffing, and we expect another approximately 25-30% for the next planning. And then we have reduced the student guarantee fee to zero for the next academic year. Policy legislation that's currently being considered in the House Education Committee or reported out to House Education, one or the other, is the name change we talked about, 2249, 2250, the state income tax credit for scholarship programs, 2251, the Oregon STEM Achievement Loan Program, and 2252, a continuously appropriated fund for the voucher program to allow that to be run more efficiently over the long term. Then other issues, the last section before the exhibit, affirmative action, that's covered on pages 214 to 216 of the White Book, the Governor's Recommended Budget. And I'm pleased to say on the technology section, we have a budget option package to increase the memory size on our AS400, but we have now been rated green on our mission critical systems by the DAS staff, so we're pleased to have reached that level now. But that does not mean that we are comfortable, as anybody should be comfortable, about what happens January 1st, 2000, until we have a business continuation plan in place for any contingency that might happen. And that's our presentation. We'd be more than pleased to answer any questions you might have. I think we've circled back and answered most of the questions that were asked yesterday. The one question that we didn't answer that I think I would draw attention to is the one Representative Winters asked regarding the age of the students receiving these grants. Independent students, the average age is 30 years old. Dependent students, the average age is 20 years old. And slightly over 50% of those independent students receiving NEED grants have children. So
thank you.
I think that basically answers the questions that we had not answered previously.
Thank you. Any other questions? Ken? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner.
So, Mr. Andy, would you like to come forward and share your thoughts?
Sure.
And while you're coming, we'll have staff do a review on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. If I could just take like 1 minute of your time to point out something that we've distributed to you this morning. There was a one-page sheet from the IRS to talk about tax benefits for higher education. And the reason why I provided copies of this is you've been hearing a lot about the situation in general for students financing higher education and the need for additional debt finance, and I just wanted to point out that not all the news is bad news as far as financing of higher ed is concerned, because in 1997, the Taxpayer Relief Act included a number of provisions which are significant regarding the funding of higher ed. If you look at the table that I distributed, the first two education credits are probably the most significant. Now you can get a credit of 100% of the first $1,000 of tuition and fees and 50% of the second $1,000 of tuition and fees. So that's a credit of up to $1,500 for the first 2 years of undergraduate study. This is a new program, and it became available for the tax returns that were just filed last April. There's another credit that's not quite as generous. It's 20% of the tuition and fees, and it is limited to $1,000 per family as opposed to per student. But this is allowed for the third and fourth year of undergraduate study as well as graduate level programs. Also, the tax law created a deductibility of interest paid on student loans. So this is the fifth column, which is interest paid on student loans. You can see that this year, 1999, up to $1,500 in interest on student loans will be deductible and in essence treated like a mortgage interest as opposed to just personal interest. These programs are very helpful. Do note, though, that the credit programs are not very beneficial to the lowest income persons, because generally the tax liability is not high enough to allow the tax for which the credit would be taken against. These particular programs are most beneficial to middle-income taxpayers, but I just want you to know that there have been some changes that have been going on recently as far as federal tax law is concerned.
Thank you, Steve. Mr. Andy?
Thank you, Chairman. This is for the record, Jerry Andine with the Oregon Independent Colleges Association. I've been watching the committee for the last 3 days take excellent, excellent testimony and ask really, really good questions and driving at large policy issues, and it's been a delight to listen to that. And consequently, I've been able to pull together some of the information that you've been asking about. I hope in some colorful ways. We're going to walk through this packet rather quickly. A lot of these pages provide information that would be fun to reflect on for quite a bit of time, but I invite you to do that later on. I'd like to get through the packet. There is a story here, and I'm going to do it by addressing five different contexts that this conversation about needy students and loans, grants, tuitions, and access to college fall in as I've been listening to the conversation the last 2 days. The first context I'd like to address very briefly is the Scholarship Commission itself. I think it's important that you hear from someone like me who doesn't work for the Commission, doesn't work for the state, but does observe the Commission day in and day out, month in and month out, and I've been doing that for almost longer than most of the Commission staff now. We have an excellent scholarship compared to other states in the country. This is really an outstanding agency, and they need to be complimented, and you need to be aware of that. Highly regarded advising services, and just one reflection of that is the default rates. It's the green sheet. It's the first sheet in your packet after the cartoon on the front and my notes on the second page. These default rates are excellent. We don't look at these every year. This particular level was done in 1986. It's the cohort from 1993, looking out 3 years. and these are excellent default rates. The question was asked, I don't recall which of you did so, but how the default rates work by institution, and I thought you'd like to see that. The information services that you've been asking about the last couple of days, the College Commission provides, are really vital information services, particularly for students not already enrolled in college and with access to financial aid directors for independent students who are thinking about going to college, and for the institutions themselves. This agency is depended upon and respected very highly. Hybrid award management program, you need to know that this is the only, this is a unique program. There is no other state agency in the country that is leveraging private dollars, using its resources and its expertise to leverage private dollars and direct those towards needy students. The private award program, and this is the second sheet now, the gray sheet. The question was asked, how are these awards distributed that the Scholarship Commission manages on behalf of sponsors and donors? And for 1998-99, the data is on that sheet by institution and summed up by sector. They also they've mentioned to you that they're dropping the 1% guarantee rate. One of the reasons they didn't mention it to you that they were down is because it's a very competitive world for guarantee agencies. And they need to be competitive in order to attract students. Competition, this is one nice indication of where competition works well to make things more efficient. We're obviously happy to see that happen, and we hope it can stay in place for some time. The second context, I call the why and the woe of the baccalaureate benchmark. The why of the baccalaureate benchmark is on the next sheet of paper, the white mixed color sheet. In 1997, average family income by degree level or by educational achievement level. Obviously, the higher up that ladder, if you're not with me, I'm right here. The higher up that ladder the Oregonians move, the better it is for them individually, the better it is for the state economically, culturally, and socially, and the better it is, obviously, for the legislative budget. The trick is to get people as far up that ladder as they want to go and as they're capable of going. And it's good for everybody that we do so. At the bottom of that chart, the unemployment rates at different levels of educational attainment might be of interest to you. Getting people up that ladder, and you've heard talk about the baccalaureate benchmarks, how many Oregonians by the age of 25 hold baccalaureate degrees. The next sheet, the yellow sheet, is taken from a monthly publication out of Iowa, and the chart there shows a national statistic over time. If you're in the top income quartile in this country, the odds are that you're going to have a baccalaureate degree by the age of 24 of over 70%. If you're in the bottom income quartile in our country, the odds are that you have a baccalaureate degree by that age less than 10%, in fact, not around 5%. This is a tragic situation. The bottom two quartiles, half of the population, less than 15%. These are the kinds of numbers that worry all of us as to how we're going to continue to build a society of equity in this country. That's one of the woes. The next sheet, Oregon's baccalaureate benchmark compared to other states. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this sheet. You see that Oregon is 43rd on the list. The box on the left is sorted by the fourth column, the growth of the percentage of students, as percentage of the population with baccalaureate degrees. The first column is the percentage in the 1980 census. The second column was the percentage in the 1990 census. The Oregon grew from 17.9 to 20.6% of our population. That's a 15% growth in the percentage. But that 15% is very low. We are not growing nearly as fast. There's 42 other states. The third column is African American 1990 baccalaureate achievement level. It shows 9.1% for Oregon, compared to the 20.6% of the total population that year. It was only 44%. African Americans are only doing 44% as well as the total population of Oregon in the achievement of baccalaureate by the age of 25. That put Oregon at the very bottom of all 50 states in that category.
The
percentage of the population is for 1990. Do you have any feel or indication of what that would look for 1999? That's almost another decade.
As you can gather, these numbers are pulled off of the U.S. Census every 10 years. I think there are some intermediate numbers, but in order to stick to the same source and not mix my federal and state sources, I'm just looking at this once every 10 years.
Do you have a feel whether we've increased, decreased?
We know that the Oregon benchmark is reporting right now that we're up to 29% of the total population with baccalaureate degrees. Obviously, you start mixing sources, and you want to get back to the original data to see if they're doing it the same way. I have no idea about the African-American count, and I suspect we don't have good state data on that. That's my suspicion.
My question is, I had asked earlier about our outreach and how many did we have in the NEED grant program, and I was advised that we can't keep those kind of statistics that identify groups, and yet we get a statistical pool from this kind of data. And I'm just wondering why you can't in one and you can in the other.
Representative, Senator Gordley just asked Grattan and myself a few minutes ago whether we could do some more digging and see whether we can break through some of these confidentiality problems that we have collecting statistics. We will look into that. I don't know if we can, but we'll give it a shot.
Thank you.
Promise you.
Senator Gordley?
Yes, just a point of information. I know that the Oregon Progress Board in January of 1998 issued a report finding the status of Oregon's minority populations in a number of categories, including education. And I can't recall the educational attainment levels from that report. But I think that would be the most current data that I would suggest you rely on, as opposed to looking at 1990 census data. And it might, Madam Chair, be useful to get that Oregon Progress Board report issued to members of this committee, since it does contain some information related to education that helps flesh out this picture for us.
Madam Chair.
Just
observing your hear about the percentages. Obviously, if you resorted this the way you sorted it was by the growth, if you just did it in absolute percentages, Oregon numbers would probably fall, we'd probably be more than 20, I mean, I didn't do it, but probably in the middle, as far as percentage of population in 1990 that had a CA degree or higher.
Madam Chair, Edwards, if you look at the United States average, which is the yellow highlighted line there, in 1990, it was 20.3, and we were 20.6.
Okay.
To the prior question, the benchmarks would be a good place to go for that kind of information. When we're trying to do national comparisons, we don't have Oregon benchmarks for all 50 states, obviously. Moving right along, the next item is another indication that we may not be doing all we can. I should mention first, Oregon is heavily weighted towards utilization of two-year institutions compared to the average state. Some western states do that. California and Washington do it. California by design. I think Washington a bit by design. I'm not sure that Oregon has intentionally designed it that we would have such a high percentage of our college students in two-year institutions. But I have graphs and charts to demonstrate that, but they were sort of complex, and for the sake of time, I left it off. I'd be happy to go over that with you. It does reflect, however, on the fact that we have a very large pool of students who have not completed a baccalaureate degree in Oregon. The private colleges have found a real market niche there, in fact, in putting together programs for degree completers. Most of the growth in the independent colleges the last decade has been older students coming back to finish their degrees. And as was mentioned 2 days ago, this is not necessarily a healthy thing, that people have to stop out and wait to finish their degrees and break up their lives in that way. The next chart, the one that's black and white, black and red on white paper, high school graduates pursuing college programs in Oregon the following fall. I direct your attention to the bottom middle of that chart, the -9%. Here again, we're tracking trends, Representative Edwards. We're looking at high school graduates in 1990 and in 1997, and then looking at how many of those graduates went on directly to college the following fall. This is your traditional student. 46% of those high school graduates went directly on to college the following fall in 1990. 42% of them went on in 1997. It is down, and this is by county. That's a decrease of 9% in the college going rate directly out of high school. And then the right side breaks that out by sector, by county. Again, one more indication that we may not be doing as well as we should be doing in helping students access college in Oregon.
Does
that indicate at all population shifts within those families? So families move out or decrease? Chairman, as Representative Edwards, it certainly could, but over, if it's just shifting among counties, then we concentrate on the statewide number at the bottom. This one, by the way, is sorted on the first red column, so that the counties that have had the greatest growth in college going rates are at the top, and the counties that have had the worst or the greatest loss in rates are at the bottom. Let me move on to the third context. Oregon's general post-secondary environment. One could write books about this and give you statistics and pictures, ad infinitum. I put together a few snapshots that I thought responded to some of the questions that I've heard you asking, not only the last couple of days, but the last two or three weeks. The first one is just a red, white, and blue, or red, gray, and blue breakout of the fall headcount enrollment for college credit at each of our institutions, each of our degree-granting, Oregon-based, regionally accredited institutions in the state. And all the grays are the community colleges, the blues are the state system, and the reds are the independent colleges. It shows a vast variety, range, of size of institution. You can assume that every one of these institutions is obviously a different kind of campus environment and academic context and academic programs, particularly among the independent schools where there's a great deal of variety because every one of them has their own board of directors and has their own way of thinking about how to educate. If that's the input, if those are the inputs, the most obvious output are the degrees. And that's the next page. And I'll just draw to your attention that there's been significant growth since 1970 in the degree output for the community colleges and for the independent colleges. And not a lot of growth for our state university institutions. That is not a comment, either good or bad, it's just an observation. But I thought you might like to see that. Mm-hmm. Other questions have been asked by the committee in the recent weeks about resident students versus non-resident students. That's the next stack bar chart. 40% of the students at our independent colleges come from other places, 17% at state system institutions, and 5% of community colleges. One should not read anything negative into that blue area on those charts. Those are good students coming to us, and many of them stay here. And if we're trying to attract high-quality, good workers, good citizens, we should be happy that some of our colleges are able to attract out-of-state students as well as educate our own students.
Gary, if I can just interrupt you, I'd like to get some three more that I'd like to testify so we can move right along with questions at 10. So.
You've asked a lot of questions about the age distribution, and I won't describe that at all. It's on the next chart, and you can easily read through that. The next one is sort of interesting, and it belies a myth that rich kids go to private colleges and poor kids go to public institutions, and the poorest of the poor go to community college. This is a study that was conducted by all three of our sectors. On the 1992 Oregonian undergraduate population on our campuses. And you can examine that at your own pleasure. You will note that the median family incomes in both the public and the private four-year institutions are almost identical, with rich kids and poor kids in both sectors. And the median family income at community colleges surprised me as being higher than I thought it was going to be. Moving right along, questions have been asked about college costs, tuition increases. The blue piece of paper shows the total cost. This would be room, board, tuition, and everything else adjusted for inflation, I'm sorry to say. In today's 1998 dollars, you see growth in all three sectors. Obviously, the independent sector is just going right off the map. And if a great concern to us, and a large reason for that is because we are financing so much grant aid from our own institutional budgets. The next one is too tiny to read, probably, but it does show the sector growth in tuition year by year, broken out in constant dollars and current dollars, the percentage growth from one year to the next. You will see that even when these free state tuitions in 1997 and 98, there's still 3% growth in the tuition because there are fees that go up. And there was 2% growth this last year, and I think we'll probably be around 2% this next year. There's growth in all three sectors. You can examine that at your leisure. The next chart simply demonstrates what I was just saying, that student aid has become the dominant growth industry in our budgets at private colleges in the state. It's up to about 25% of the budget at the expense of instructional costs. Administration is flat and falling off. Plant and operations are way down. As you can see, what the student aid budget is doing to our institutions. The last couple of three, the yellow ones, I have been tracking for some years the resident and non-resident tuition of state universities, one in each state. I try to go for the land-grant school or the flagship school, and don't ask me why I chose Oregon State in Oregon, but I did, and that's the one I've been tracking for some years. This is sorted on the darker column. It shows that Oregon's resident tuition at its land-grant institution is within $100 of the national average of all state institutions. And Washington's is right below the national average. California, just to point out, is up there at number 12, quite a bit above ours. And then a lot of questions were asked about what the costs are in each institution in Oregon. This is a chart that we do every year that shows the breakout by school for all schools that are eligible for NEED grant recipients. And the far right column shows the number of NEED grant recipients at that institution last year paying those bills. Now I get to the part that I really want to get to, and that is how we compare to other states in our grant funding programs. There are five columns here on these next three pages. I don't need to go through all of them. Each of them has a different heading, and each of them says that our NEED grant program is underfunded on a national average by at least 50%. In order to get to the level of national mediocrity, we would have to double our NEED grant budget. That's embarrassing to me. If you turn four pages back to a line chart, you look at the trend of this just with our two sister states. The West Coast, the Western states generally don't have a lot of independent colleges except for Oregon, Washington, and California. And Oregon and Washington, California have over time paid attention to student aid issues. But you will note that California is way ahead of us on dollars spent per resident, has been for many years. Washington was way below us back in 1979, and they have just boomed. They have really started to take their student aid program seriously, and I just heard 2 days ago they have just increased their need-based aid program in this legislative session for the next 2 years by 25%, and they have launched a merit-based program that's going to cost about $46 million one biennium out from now, which is very much like a similar program that we are bringing forward to you in another bill. That's embarrassing.
I've got three more people that I can.
Okay, just quickly, is that chart, does this somehow, we heard from the Scholarship Commission that they're trying to target a certain income level with their NEED grants. Does this chart reflect that level of need? That's the population that you should be seeing who are serving and underserving? And this is probably an aggregate total state population divided by grant, right?
Total state population divided by grant, that's all that is. The last three pages, the yellow one, shows what other states are doing in the state of Georgia, 3 or 4 years ago, launched a major scholarship program, merit-based, called the HOPE program. It attracts a lot of attention. All of a sudden, states all over the country are picking up on this. This is what we could find out just a couple weeks ago, what's going on in other states. Washington, as I said, just launched one. It has passed. It was tied to a state university bill up there that allowed the state universities to raise their tuition up to 5%, left up to each institution. Last week, on Monday, you received in your offices the white sheet of paper reflecting Oregon citizens' interest in funding students at this point in time. And then the pink sheet walks through the bill that we just passed out of the House Education Committee yesterday that is coming to you and that six of you at least are sponsors of, and that's the bill that puts a lot more money into the hands of students. And I'm not going to take the time, because I know there are other people behind me, to walk through that. I hope I'll have a chance to do that on another occasion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much. Tamara, Breton Turns, and Nance Swamp, and I'm going to have you all come up. And, okay, I didn't have them on the sign up ship. All right.
and Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the same reason, I'm just going to submit my testimony and tell you that Oregon Community College Association very much supports this budget.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for your brevity for trying to get everybody in.
Okay, for the record, this morning, my name is Matt Swanson. I am the State Affairs Coordinator for the Associated Students of the University of Oregon, and I'm also a board member for the Oregon Student Association. I guess I'll try to keep this as brief as possible. You all, I'm sure, gained a wealth of knowledge this morning, and thank you for staying around.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I wanted to also tell a story of how the Oregon Need Grant affects students, give you a student perspective on this, and why this budget that we're looking at is so important for students who are currently enrolled at Oregon colleges and universities, and also for the future of Oregon. In 1971, when this grant was created, of course, it was meant to serve low- and middle-income students in their quest to go to some sort of post-secondary education, and that was, at that time, it was doing a great job. I know this is a very important year for me because my mother was in the first class to receive that grant, and ultimately, she's been able to go on, become self-sufficient, get a job, and now she's the proud parent of four college students because we had a role model that she may never have had. So that's something that I think this grant really has been able to affect my life in a very positive way. To speak to where the grant is now, 11% of the cost of education is simply not enough. Students are not receiving the kind of access that they deserve to post-secondary education. They're graduating with debt that is far above any other generation in the state of Oregon. And really, what this means for us is that we need to see an increase in the size of the grant. We are supporting a -1 amendment to this bill as the Oregon Student Association that would increase the award size to 15% of cost. And that is something that hopefully this body will take into consideration because it has the opportunity to alter the reality facing many students today, which is either a lack of access to post-secondary education or a debt burden so heavy that they really cannot contribute to the economy in the future after they graduate. So I guess with that being said, I will end my testimony and take any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much for coming down. Any more testimony? All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming down and letting us hear your views. And with that, the session starts in 3 minutes, and we are adjourned.